that the second he steps back onto British territory, he will be arrested and sent to the U.S., where he's unlikely to receive a fair trial and would likely spend the rest of his life in prison. Those powerful interests want him to pay.
It is a historic test of press freedom. The corporate media, which once profited from him, has now abandoned Julian Assange, and they could face the same threat to their freedom to publish classified information were he to be arrested.
Well, I want to welcome my co-host, Elizabeth Voss, for our first joint session, the 18th Vigil for Julian Assange. We're going to look now at some of the headlines of the past week involving WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Of course, the biggest story was the testimony by Michael Cohen, former lawyer for Donald Trump, where he brought up a WikiLeaks issue. And that was, of course, something he said in his opening statement. And I'm going to read that part. And then we're going to dissect that, hopefully for the rest of the show, with some of our guests. Cohen said, quote, "As I earlier stated, Mr. Trump knew from Roger Stone in advance about the WikiLeaks drop of emails. In July 2016, days before the Democratic convention, I was in Mr. Trump's office when his secretary announced that Roger Stone was on the phone. Mr. Trump puts Mr. Stone on the speakerphone. Mr. Stone told Mr. Trump that he had just gotten off the phone with Julian Assange and that Mr. Assange told Mr. Stone that within a couple of days, there would be a massive dump of emails that would damage Hillary Clinton's campaign. Mr. Trump responded by stating to the effect of, quote, wouldn't that be great? During the questioning in Cohen's testimony, Representative Thomas Massie and Cohen had this exchange that I think is extremely revealing and should end this matter right there. Representative Massie said, you said, and this is also in your testimony, in the days before the Democratic convention, you became privy to a conversation that some of Hillary Clinton emails would be leaked. Is that correct? Cohen said, correct. Massie, okay, was that in, you said, late July? Do you know the exact day? Cohen, I believe it was either the 18th or the 19th, and I would guess that it would be the 19th. Representative Massie, but it was definitely July. Cohen, I believe so, yes. Representative Massie, do you know that was public knowledge in June? This was Mr. Assange. And I'd like to submit this, unanimous consent, to submit this for the record. The chairman says, Chairman Cummings, without objection, so ordered. Massie says, Mr. Assange reported to the media on June 12th that those emails would be leaked. So I'm not saying you have fake news, he's telling Cohen. I'm saying you have old news, and there's really not much to that. There's really not much to that. There shouldn't have been much to that. This should have made it an open and shut case that there was indeed no so-called collusion between a member of Trump's campaign, Roger Stone, and WikiLeaks. First of all, WikiLeaks strongly denies that Julian Assange ever had a phone conversation with Stone. On February 27, just 3 days ago, WikiLeaks put out a statement on Michael Cohen's testimony to Congress. It says WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange has never had a telephone call with Roger Stone. WikiLeaks publicly teased its pending publications on Hillary Clinton and published about 30,000 of her emails on 16 March 2016. That's when they first revealed that these emails would be coming. Secondly, Assange announced those emails on British TV on June 2016. That video was made available again in the wake of Cohen's testimony by WikiLeaks. On their Twitter page, you could watch Julian Assange telling a television audience that they have some emails coming out about Hillary Clinton. So we're made to believe now that Cohen in July is saying that Roger Stone tipped off Trump, candidate Trump, that these emails were coming. Now, even if WikiLeaks had shared such information in advance, it wouldn't be a crime, nor any collusion to steal the emails. The only crime here is someone took the emails that was the private property of the Democratic National Committee and of John Podesta, the chairman of the Clinton campaign. But there's no suggestion that there was any effort to steal those emails. It was only a matter of knowing in advance, which has been elevated to a crime, knowing something in advance when the whole world knew it in advance as well. In a tweet on February 27, quote, anybody who believes that Julian Assange was able to phone Roger Stone from inside the Ecuadorian embassy with neither the GCHQ, NSA, CIA, MI5, or FBI intercepting the call is severely deluded. The combined budget of those agencies is $41 billion U.S. dollars. Michael Cohen's testimony is obviously nonsense. Unfortunately, it's not obvious to a large segment of the population. That's something we're going to talk about.
The second major news event to discuss today is the fact that Chelsea Manning has been subpoenaed. And we have a quote from the New York Times who wrote on the subject saying, quote, Chelsea Manning, the former Army intelligence analyst convicted in 2013 of leaking archives of secret military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks, revealed in an interview that she had been subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury and vowed to fight it. The subpoena does not say what prosecutors intend to ask her about, but it was issued in the Eastern District of Virginia and comes after prosecutors inadvertently disclosed in November that Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, has been charged under seal in that district. Ms. Manning, who provided a copy of the subpoena to the New York Times, said that her legal team would file a motion on Friday to quash it, arguing that it would violate her constitutional rights to force her to appear. She declined to say whether she would cooperate if that failed. Quote, from Manning, given what is going on, I'm opposing this, she said. I want to be very forthright. I have been subpoenaed. I don't know the parameters of the subpoena apart from that I am expected to appear. I don't know what I'm going to be asked. And that's the end of that quote from her. Joshua Steve, a spokesman for the Office of the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, declined to comment, but there are multiple reasons to believe that the subpoena is related to the investigation of Mr. Assange. Among them, the subpoena was requested by Gordon D. Cromberg, an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District. After an inadvertent court filing revealed that Mr. Assange had been charged under seal, it was Cromberg who successfully argued before a judge that any such charges remain a secret and should not be unsealed. Moreover, Ms. Manning said Mr. Cromberg has told her lawyers in vague terms that prosecutors want to talk to her about her past statements. During her court martial, Ms. Manning delivered a lengthy statement about how she came to copy archives of secret documents and send them to WikiLeaks, including her online interactions with someone who was likely Mr. Assange. And so that's definitely going to be a topic of discussion for this week's vigil. The third point of news to discuss, though, is Tulsi Gabbard and her defense of WikiLeaks. We have the Washington Examiner writing, quote, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, a 2020 Democratic candidate for the presidency, defended the work of WikiLeaks during an event in New Hampshire on Saturday, saying that the stolen information published by the secrets leaking organization has, quote, spurred some necessary change. And while that may not be the strongest endorsement, you know, one could imagine from somebody who is running as a Democratic, you know, candidate in the primary process, you know, considering that situation, that is a pretty strong statement, especially in comparison with other candidates in that field. And then the last point of news to discuss is the fact that UK, you know, considering that situation, that is a pretty strong statement, especially in comparison with other candidates in that decision. And then regarding Julian Assange, of news to discuss, he is in arbitrary detention. He's the first UK MP to do so, and he's now been suspended from Parliament, or from the Labour Party, I believe, but he's not been expelled. And that there is a whole lot more going on with that story that we'll discuss later in the vigil.
Related to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, who has been nominated for the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize, we should add. On March 3rd, that's 2 days from now, Sunday, at 2 p.m. at Martin Place in Sydney, Australia, John Pilger, the legendary Australian journalist in Australia, at the State Library, there will also be a hopefully very large event, people coming into the streets. We have a lot of things to talk about just between us right now. For example, let's leave the Cohen testimony aside for a minute. I want to talk to you about this Williamson situation. I think this is beyond troubling. First of all, and we've run at Consortium News, and you may have also at Disobedient Media, plenty of stories about a couple of months ago about the phoniness of this anti-Semitism charge against the Labour Party. It's clearly trumped up to destroy Corbyn in particular, who terrifies the establishment. The possible ways for Julian Assange to get out of that embassy is if Corbyn does indeed become prime minister and allows him to leave, and if he has that authority, make sure that this very minor charge of skipping bail on an investigation that's since long been dropped from Sweden by Sweden. There were never any charges in that case. There are no charges as well. Arrest warrant. He's not been charged with skipping bail. That arrest totally irrelevant now. His party allowing this MP to be suspended and smeared again with this anti-Semitism charge, which it and agrees with a United Nations panel's decision that they've reiterated that Assange is being held arbitrarily and he should be released and even compensated. Right out and even say that he was supporting Assange or WikiLeaks, but that he supported the UN decision about WikiLeaks and Assange. True, a bit troubling, would you say?
Absolutely. No, I think it's really fascinating that he tweeted this statement saying, quote, "I back the UN," and he was, you know, kind of retweeting in that post Mark Curtis's tweet about the United Nations decision regarding Assange. So he posted that on the 23rd of December last year, so just a few months ago. And now we have this furor about an unrelated topic where he is, you know, it's almost like it seems to me to be a pretext in order to kind of, you know, punish him for possibly this opinion regarding Assange. You know, as we mentioned, he was the only UK member of parliament to say something like this. And even though we've had, you know, we've seen members of the German parliament say, you know, make similar statements or make statements supporting Assange, he is the only person in the UK to say this. It's saddening to see that these types of trumped up allegations and smears can so successfully blacken someone's name. When they can very conveniently, when they've said something that is completely contrary to the establishment's narrative, whether that's about Assange or whether it's about the Integrity Initiative, which I believe he was also vocal about as well. And that's another narrative that would be very inconvenient for the UK establishment, especially.
The reasons for his suspension were not, amongst those reasons, were not the fact that he retweeted that tweet by Mark Curtis in defending the UN decision. But certainly that would not make him a popular person amongst at least a certain part of the Labour Party, which is the Blairite wing, which is almost indistinguishable from the Tories on many, many issues. He's being smeared with anti-Semitism simply because he says the Labour Party had given too much ground, that's the quote, in the face of that criticism. The Labour Party had been too apologetic over the anti-Semitism charges or smears and was being demonized as racist, as a racist, bigoted party. I think Corbyn himself, who was an ally of Williamson, has said that, you know, there's anti-Semitism in almost any organization and any party. And yes, there's some of that inside the Labour Party, but it was not a racist party and bigoted party. I mean, the idea of trumping that up like that is so obvious to destroy them politically with that smear. I think the reason behind this entire anti-Semitism campaign is that the Labour Party is being led by a member of the Labour Party who is true in many ways to the traditions of that party, which is to defend labor, working class, and to have very left-wing positions on foreign affairs. And domestically, and of course, the establishment does not want to see Corbyn become prime minister. So, and he's quite popular, particularly within his party, who tried to remove him as leader. And the funny thing is, about a week ago, one of the seven members of the Labour Party that left, you know, in this effort to undermine Corbyn, because they claimed that the party was racist and anti-Semitic, one of these women, I'm forgetting her name, I think it's Angela Smith, but I could check that, was interviewed the day after she left with this big news in the UK that seven members of the Labour Party had defected because of the so-called anti-Semitism and racism in the party. And when she was talking on live TV, she said, and I'm quoting her, that this is not just an issue for, you know, for people of color, but also white working class people, but not just about people with a certain tinge. She's up. And to drag him into this, because we don't know, we're not saying that was because of what he said about the UN's decision on Julian Assange, but it's, you have to assume anyone who's actually kind of on the left side of the Labour Party is being targeted. Elizabeth, tell us a little more about the Integrity Initiative. I think you've written a bit about that.
Absolutely, yeah. We know that the Integrity Initiative is essentially this this organization that I believe is listed as a, you know, an NGO or a nonprofit type of NGO, but it's related directly and through intermediaries to the United Kingdom establishment and the government, actually. And essentially what we saw and what a lot of reporting, not just by Disobedient Media, but also by Grey Zone and by UK media as well, has shown is that the Integrity Initiative and its proxies have been very, very much part of this kind of push for, promoting Russiagate and the Russiagate scandal, basically smearing independent journalists, including Disobedient Media and myself, when we would when we reported on issues like the Catalonian independence movement. There was a major pushback article from El País, the a Spanish, you know, kind of paper of record, and basically what we saw was that this smear took place, you know, a year or so ago or maybe more, but essentially the writer involved and just the outlet itself was very much related to and tied to the Integrity Initiative and its proxies. We also had attacks on Disobedient Media from entities like the Atlantic Council, which is also a partner with the Integrity Initiative, and it just goes on. And that's only Disobedient Media as an example that I'm obviously familiar with because it was kind of our experience, but there's a whole lot more to it than just that, of course. And so we have a quote from a commenter saying, quote, Chris Williamson was pushing for the Integrity Initiative to be the subject of a parliamentary inquiry. And so you can imagine that in addition to Chris Williamson's statements, you know, backing the UN and the UN's ruling on Assange, that type of position would put you into the sort of position of being targeted by the establishment, to put it lightly, for sure.
Of course, this was supposed to be a highly secret operation, and the really chilling part, especially if you're a UK citizen, is that the government, the Defense Ministry and the Foreign Office and government money was poured into this operation. And one of their main targets was Jeremy Corbyn. So you've got the sitting Tory government basically funding a secret operation to smear their political opponent using the official organs of the state. What this initiative did was to draw in academics, journalists, and government officials and military officials to work to smear opponents of the establishment. And one of them was, of course, Corbyn, but also Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. So, I mean, it's very clear what's going on here. This is an extraordinarily upsetting government-funded, government-backed, highly partisan attack on anyone who they see as a threat to the establishment interests. You know, they're in power. They've got this enormous ability to influence events, and they are living a good lifestyle, and they love their power and their money. And anybody who comes along and tries to say, hey, wait a minute, you're doing a couple of things here wrong, and the people are suffering from your policies, and whether that be war, going to war perpetually, or your domestic economic policies, of course, those people have to be stopped because they're in my opinion, they're not exactly in the strongest position, establishment figures. They're nervous. They feel threatened by anyone who just criticizes them because whether they realize it or not consciously, they're standing on not very solid ground. NATO and others, it's an odious organization that has also been taken on by Facebook to help in their what could only be called censorship of Facebook for, again, criticisms that the establishment does not like. So, I mean, we're supposed to be living in democracies, Elizabeth, and you have to realize, I think, that they are severely challenged, if not weakened to the point of not existing anymore. And yet it fades into the background, you know, this becomes part of normal life. No matter these outrages, for example, Snowden's revelations of a few years ago, big splash, a lot of people upset, mainstream media covered it, sales of 1984 by George Orwell skyrocketed. People said, damn, we're living in what Orwell had predicted way back there in 1939 when he wrote this book. that we are 49, rather, he predicted the dystopia we're now living in, and no one's talking about that anymore in the mainstream. I mean, crazy people like us are talking about it because we realize it's how significant it is.
It's the same lack of evidence we have with alleged Russian hacking. Like, well, if they hacked, just show us the evidence. I'm sure the NSA has it. I mean, Bill Binney said that many, many times, and there's no way to really push back against that.
There are his legions of defenders that they've got that evidence, but they can't reveal it right now. You're arrested. They're not going to be extradited to the U.S. So when you're in a situation like that as a prosecutor, you could put it pretty much anything you want. Having created this maniacal atmosphere of Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, creating this this context in which anybody, you mentioned the word Russian and someone from Trump team met a Russian or spoke to a Russian, and all hell breaks loose. And it doesn't matter what, you know, that is not a crime to talk to a Russian. We are not the United States that is not at war with Russia. My reading of the law on treason, including from the U.S. Constitution, is that you need to be at war with a country in order to help that enemy. Russia is not formally an enemy of the United States. And yet, whenever there's a mention of a Russian, or in this case, there's this talk about a conversation with Assange and Stone in which the Trump campaign was advised in advance. Now, you tell me what statute under U.S. laws is knowing something in advance a crime.
I'm not a legal mind, but I'm pretty sure that that does not exist. So, yeah, no, it's insane. It's really insane.
And on top of that, the whole world knew in advance.
So exactly.
Just on its own, okay, even if they were told in advance, so what? What does that mean? They could prepare their exploitation of that fact, I guess. If you're in a political campaign and you know there's some dirt coming out, and there's not even an indication here that they got copies of the emails before anybody else. Is there? Did Cohen say that? I didn't hear him say that.
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge, yeah.
Even that wouldn't be, in my opinion, a crime, but it would be, okay, they want to help the Trump campaign by being able to read all these emails before the public can, so they can prepare statements, they can learn how to exploit this very damaging information about Hillary for their campaign. So that would, I would admit, that's an aid. I would have been an aid to the Trump campaign to give, just to give them not a heads up, but the actual documents, the actual emails, so that the moment they were made public, you know, the Trump campaign, if they knew what they were doing, could come out with all of these statements and point out things to the public. And this is how they cheated Bernie Sanders. And look at her, the hypocrite, saying she's for the people when she's giving all these speeches to Wall Street. And this is what she said, et cetera. But that didn't happen. They didn't give them the emails.
Exactly.
They just said they told him in advance, but the world knew at least a month before that those emails were coming. This is so out of the ballpark insanity that they're
I mean, I remember in March 2016, as you read earlier when we were going over the headlines, that there was that announcement about that way back in March. I mean, I remember that. So it's amazing to me to see all of these legacy press outlets act like that just didn't happen. They're just completely and blatantly and overtly rewriting history. It's insane.
Act like it never happened. That is a great sentence to explain the MO of the corporate media. Rather than blatantly lying, although that could happen and has happened, plagiarism, there are all kinds of, you know, there are some really bad reporters out there who've cheated and they've gotten in trouble. But that's not the way it's done. It's by leaving things out. In a story like this, that Assange had announced it, and in March, WikiLeaks had indicated these emails were coming. If you write that in this story, in the context of what Cohen said in his testimony, story's dead. It's over. They don't want that. They need to milk this story for ratings, for readership, and for their political leanings and objectives, which are to attack Trump on everything except when he wants to invade Venezuela or bomb Syria. Then he's a great guy and you have bipartisan support. It is just so awful.
They call that statesmanship. They're like, oh yes, he's learning the ropes, and it's disgusting. It's absolutely abhorrent. But I think, yeah, I think that this also goes back to, in my opinion, watching this furor about Cohen and all of that develop. You know, meanwhile, we have this article from the New York Times about Chelsea Manning being subpoenaed. What I feel that this narrative is being blown up to this degree right now, in my opinion, because it helps to distract the public from Julian Assange being prosecuted and persecuted because of the Manning era emails. I really strongly feel that, for example, the really fake Guardian story about Manafort, you know, visiting Assange, and that never happened. There was no evidence for that, but that came out very shortly after the sealed charges against Assange were inadvertently confirmed. Like that really came on the back of that. So I think that, in my opinion, a lot of this is coming from not just the motivation of vilifying Trump and trying to create collusion out of nowhere, but also from distracting from the real reason that Julian Assange is being prosecuted and persecuted. So,
well, it's the WikiLeaks lawyers have been saying since a long time that there was this indictment sealed in the Eastern District of Virginia and Alexandria, Virginia. Has spoken to anyone at WikiLeaks. And they can't tell you they don't know where Julian Assange is and that he could, can't be found. I think they know where he is, and they can easily send somebody to that conference room and sit across from him and ask him a whole bunch of questions. They've never done that. They've never contacted Craig Murray, who's willing to speak. They've not contacted Kim.com, who is willing to speak to them, who sent a letter to the Mueller office saying, I have information that's important for you in your investigation. Please let me talk to you. And they just ignored that letter. So why now Manning? Why do you think that they, and what do you think, she doesn't know what she's going to be asked. And she's fighting, by the way, this subpoena and trying to find a legal way around it. Down to asking people direct questions about WikiLeaks and their role in all of this, if there was one. But again, she would know nothing about the Russian, so-called Russian investigation. She was in prison.
I believe it was May 2017 she was released, if I remember correctly.
Right. So that was after the election, right? 2017.
Right.
So this should have nothing to do with Russiagate. What is the point of all of this? Unless it goes back, as you're pointing out, to the original, what the indictment's about, which is not going to be about Russia, because A, they don't really have any damn evidence, right? That's why they're not even bothering to ask, it seems. Why bother when you know what they're going to tell you, that we didn't do it, and they can't prove that they did. This is what all the mania has been about. So you believe that they're circling back to the early days, about what the indictment's really based on, what events around 2010. Around 2010, that's what you believe?
Absolutely. And I mean, when we look back at the Podesta and DNC emails, those emails were not classified material. That was not sensitive material that was, so you can't really, it's just implausible to think that the charges in the Eastern District of Virginia would relate to that. It's just kind of impossible. You know, it's Mueller is impaneled in, or is set up in DC. It's a completely separate location. So I think that what the New York Times article confirms is that this does go back to 2010. And I think it also suggests that it's more to do with the 2010 kind of era of WikiLeaks publications rather than even Vault 7, which again, that was classified and sensitive information, which, many people have said that maybe these charges are in relation to that. Maybe in part they are, but I think this is really, the central charges that as you mentioned, have been existed since at least 2010, and as you said, the WikiLeaks legal counsel has said that many, many times. So I think that the idea that this is just out of nowhere is ridiculous, and I think that the latest from the New York Times really does confirm that this goes back to Manning era material. And the reason that that's important to take note of is because the establishment press. The majority of the establishment press was really behind Julian Assange and WikiLeaks when they were publishing that material. When Collateral Murder came out, when the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, all of those publications were really celebrated by liberal media. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it makes them appear very hypocritical if they're now, celebrating Assange being prosecuted for those publications. I think that that makes them look very hypocritical. And I think that that's, again, part of the impetus behind continuing to smear him, even though it's baseless, regarding, you know, the Cohen testimony, Russiagate, the entire mess. It's because it really lets them off the hook for their own hypocrisy.
You said that those emails were not classified, but, you know, let's not forget that Chris Cuomo on CNN said that you're not allowed to read them. Only we're allowed in the media to read them. One of the most astounding statements among so many astounding statements in this whole Russiagate fiasco that I've ever heard. And he, you know, this guy should have been fired for something like that. He probably thought that they were classified information, the emails. But even then, why would only the people in the media be allowed to watch it? If it's classified, nobody in the media is supposed to be allowed to see it either. So there's no situation where any classified documents are permitted to be read by the media only, but not the public. Isn't the media's job to communicate with the public? So if they could read it, then they're supposed to be silent about it. I'm sorry, I'm going on about this Cuomo statement because it's so ridiculous. But because you said that they weren't classified, but Chris Cuomo has a different view. I'm joking about that. The more important point here about proving that this is about those early days and the sealed complaint or indictment is that it's the same guy, Kronberg. What's his first name here?
Let me see.
Yeah, Kronberg. I see. He's a U.S. district. Yeah.
Gordon Kronberg.
Assistant U.S. DA in the Eastern District of Virginia. Now, Kronberg was in that courtroom of Leonie Brinkema, courtroom 700 in Alexandria when I was there for the first hearing on whether to unseal them. And he made the government argument why they shouldn't. He also apologized for the inadvertent release of those two paragraphs in a completely unrelated criminal case that was also being handled by his office. So it appears that somebody pasted in from Assange's indictment into this other guy's indictment, something that they shouldn't have. That indictment was made public when that other guy was arrested, and it was some garden variety violent crime and nothing at all to do with Assange. And that's how the public became aware that this one sentence in those two paragraphs says, because Assange has been charged. So Brinkema decided ultimately that that was not proof that he has been charged, and that the government says that they are not confirming or denying whether he has been charged. So on that basis, we cannot make the indictment public. But Kronberg shows up again in this story because he wants to talk to Chelsea Manning. So that indictment, if it's sealed, is not complete yet, and they're continuing to investigate it. So it would have absolutely nothing to do with the Russiagate investigation, not that it isn't troubling for Julian Assange, and because, I think there is an indictment or a complaint of some sort. And bringing her in there will be tough because, first of all, we know already, because she was outed, that she was the source. That's why she went to jail. This creep who she was communicating with, I can't remember his name, maybe that's on purpose. I don't want to remember his name. We, of course, exposed her, and she wound up going to jail and being treated very harshly. I really don't know what she could add. She doesn't know what she could add. I don't know. It's a really bizarre story why they would bring her up at this point. Again, well, it's not about Russia.
I can't speculate either, but we have one, we have Bella Magnani on Twitter saying it's not speculation what DOJ wants Chelsea Manning to testify about. She says, if you look at the top right-hand corner of the grand jury subpoena, you'll see 10GJ3793. That's the WikiLeaks case number targeting the, quote, founders, owners, or managers of WikiLeaks. So thank you, Bella, for that tweet. That's really informative. So, and I'll link that in the live chat as well as the video, so people can take a look at that if they like.
I'm just going to change to another subject from our headlines. Tulsi Gabbard is someone who, clearly the establishment doesn't want any part of. She is completely from out of left field when it comes to the rest of the candidates, the huge field that's developing already of the Democratic candidates on foreign policy. We've got Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who are going to be somewhat more progressive than the centrist wing when it comes to economic policy, which is all well and good, and holding Wall Street to account, creating, in Bernie's idea, some kind of democratic socialism, which, and I have to say, really has ticked off establishment, including Mr. Donald Trump, because if you're the union address, which was one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen. I don't watch a lot of TV, but I did watch that. And if you don't watch a lot of TV, you get this sense of eavesdropping on something. You know, it was like all these very powerful people in America inside the House of Representatives chamber in the Capitol building. And then Trump's up there, and I thought he delivered a chillingly effective speech. But it was one line he said in there, and he said, "America will never be a socialist country." And I was, I think, addressed to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, to Bernie Sanders, to anybody else who was thinking about socialism or some version of it, and also to the leaders, I think, of Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. I think they're targeting those countries because of for the domestic reasons as well, very much like the original Cold War, when they went after, in the developing world, any countries that seemed to lean towards socialism or the Soviet Union and would be somehow an encouragement to anybody in the U.S. thinking along those lines. So Trump went out of his way to attack those people. Tulsi Gabbard has been ignored by corporate media. CNN gave Kamala Harris, like a day after she announced, a town hall meeting, as if the campaign was underway already. It is so obvious what they're doing. This is not in any way journalism. This is purely pushing an agenda. It has become so obvious to those of us who could think critically about it. But as I was mentioning earlier, when you're living in this environment and everything becomes normalized, people don't think twice about that. That Kamala Harris, according to CNN, should be and will be the nominee, and Tulsi Gabbard is not worth 5 seconds. Regime change. This is her issue. And it's also raised a topic you never hear in the mainstream or in the Capitol, that the U.S. has dealt with some really nasty groups in Syria, in Libya, and elsewhere, earlier in the 80s in Afghanistan, jihadist groups, terrorist groups, if it serves a short-term American agenda. And these groups often come back and blow back to hit and attack the U.S. because they, at that moment, they shared a common enemy, and the U.S. showered them with money and weapons and intelligence and whatnot. So Tulsi has taken that on. And for her now to say that WikiLeaks has done has brought about reforms that were needed, is that what her quote was?
I believe she said, that the documents that they published provoked needed necessary change. I think it was something along those lines. And while some people might think that that's, not enough, I think that as a presidential candidate within the DNC kind of framework, that's still a relatively brave statement to make, especially when you're up against people like Kamala Harris, who not only is being given these free, huge amounts of free airtime from outlets like CNN and its cohorts, but also has been sort of, I would say, protected on Twitter. So, because I've noticed that a number of people from different political persuasions have been suspended permanently on Twitter simply for criticizing her. Lots of different people have had their accounts absolutely deleted because they criticized Kamala Harris. So she's being not only given a platform, but she's also being protected from criticism. So I definitely think that suggests that she's basically the chosen presumptive candidate at this point.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I was not aware that people who criticized her on Twitter have been losing their accounts. That is, earlier that the liberal media liked and republished plenty of WikiLeaks stuff going back to that time around 2010 about the Afghan war cables, about collateral damage. And why do you think that is? Well, who was president then? George W. Bush, Republican. So when WikiLeaks reveals stuff that hurts a Republican president, that's on the front page of the New York Times. This is what
it's sad that it comes down to that. Yeah, that it's the red versus blue type of scenario. That's really sad.
It's beyond sad. It's beyond sad, that kind of partisanship. When, you know, they will willingly say that a United States government committed a war crime. They're not saying that, but they're publishing information that clearly indicates that. Prima facie evidence of war crimes in those videos. Okay? They're willing to say that, but they're not, the liberal media is not saying that the United States did that. They're saying George W. Bush did that. Right?
He wasn't
a political candidate. He was the president. He was representing this country as its leader, as its chief executive, and his military under his command committed those war crimes. So that was published in the New York Times. When we now have revelations that the top candidate in the Democratic Party cheated her primary opponent, probably out of the nomination, and that he very well probably would have beaten Trump, all the polls showed, and they preferred her because she was running the DNC. It was basically an organ of the Clinton campaign. It was not an independent organization to fairly set out a primary so everybody can get a chance that the people, you know, the party members who vote primaries decide. Then, you know, WikiLeaks has got to be prosecuted. Julian has to be prosecuted now. But, yeah. You know, the prosecution came about because of, as we're saying, though, the earlier publication of these documents. And I've been working on this piece now for too long. But when you're an editor, as both of us are, you know how if you're dealing with other people's work, your own work suffers. So I don't want to complain too much about that. It's just a fact of being an editor. So I've been working on this piece about Espionage Act and Julian Assange. And the unfortunate fact is that the way it's written and based on some amendments in 1961, that anyone in the world, that it's a global treaty now, but it was originally 1917, only for somebody who leaked classified information on U.S. territory. Now it's anywhere in the world. And mere possession or dissemination by a journalist or a publisher is liable to be prosecuted. It's a draconian, horrible act, but it's the fact, and it has happened before. I'm discovering there was a publication called The Masses back in 1918 that their editors were prosecuted on the Espionage Act for certain publications that ran afoul of the U.S. government during a time of war. So they are clearly wanting to punish Julian Assange. And I worry that this Trump administration will do what other administrations since the Wilson days have not done, which is to use that provision of the act to go after a publisher. Even though there's been a challenge to the Supreme Court and it has withstood a First Amendment challenge, Espionage Act, which seemed to be in violation of that. The issue being the government cannot use prior restraint. In other words, practice censorship in advance of a publication. Cannot tell a publication you can't publish that, even if it's classified. But they can wait for after publication and then they can prosecute. But governments have refused to do that in each case. When Dan Ellsberg gave the papers to Senator Mike Gravel, and Gravel read them into the congressional record at a subcommittee legislative act to say whatever he wants, and you cannot be questioned for that, so that you could any member of Congress can declassify anything they want and not get in trouble. Make it public if it's in the act, if it's during a legislative act. But afterward, Gravel then published Depending on Papers in Beacon Press in Boston. And it was made known to him at that time that he was then liable for prosecution, U.S. Senator, because he published outside of a legislative act classified information that had already been made public but was still considered classified. But Nixon didn't go after him. And then we have the example of the Obama administration wanting to go after Assange as well. And as far as I know, in 2010, the president was Barack Obama, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
When this indictment was put together?
I believe so, yes.
It was Obama who's prosecuted Tom Drake. It's Obama who went after Chelsea Manning. It's Obama who wanted to prosecute Assange, and probably put together his court that in his government put together this indictment or a criminal complaint, that seal that we're talking about. But they were worried that if Assange is prosecuted, that that opens up all news organizations who also publish classified information, who can be charged under the Espionage Act. Technically, it's there. They prosecute WikiLeaks and Assange. You know, people are going to say, well, the New York Times is getting away with it. Why don't you prosecute them?
The New York Times would wake up to the issue. You know, it's ridiculous they haven't already. So I think, yeah. I mean, I know that their lawyer has stated that they would be liable, as you mentioned, but it seems that the culture of the New York Times and the opinions and news that they publish still seems to be blind to that fact, despite their own lawyers, you know, basically admitting that they would be liable.
Absolutely. They're trying to frame Assange as being part of some collusion because he supposedly told in a phone conversation that the NSA cannot produce that these emails are coming out when the public already knew that.
Well, and it's the ultimate irony. It's the ultimate irony that what they revealed was the election rigging, essentially. And then, and not only that, but that then they are accused of participating in election rigging by revealing election rigging. I mean, it's just mind-boggling when you look at it from a big picture kind of perspective.
March, she said, was when WikiLeaks announced the press emails, but the next month was April. Never mind. Back on to the ridiculous insane of this. They hacked, they interfered by telling us our primary was stolen. Okay, next.
And then we also have, obviously, the news this week as well, the Chagos Islands, and forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that, you know, there was a big ruling and win in the case regarding the UK's refusal, and the UK then refused to accept that ruling. But basically, that story also hinged on a WikiLeaks cable, and with that, and that story also demonstrates the hugely wide-ranging value of the documents that WikiLeaks has published, because without WikiLeaks, so many different varying stories would not have been possible, or the, you know, this legal case wouldn't have been possible. And that is absolutely, it's incredible that one organization has been able to produce so much material on so many infinitely, you know, differing stories. So sometimes those stories become relevant years and years after WikiLeaks actually publishes the material, and you know, they don't know in advance what's going to be relevant to who when. So I think that that's a really great example of the way in which WikiLeaks has just been proven invaluable to the public record. So, and I believe WikiLeaks's Twitter timeline is a great place to look for information and updates on that case. Joe, are you back with us? I think your internet dropped for a moment.
But I automatically reconnected, which was a relief.
Good.
Yes, infinitely, infinitely important to help the public, and infinitely a threat to those whose crimes and corruption are revealed. And as you say, the irony is that the emails were accurate. Everything WikiLeaks has ever published is accurate. They verify everything before they publish it. It's the government's own words that are crucifying them. You know, this is not a traditional type of journalism where you go out and interview people and rely on documents and you try to piece it together and get an approximation of the truth. This is the absolute unvarnished words of the government themselves in these documents. So why it's so extraordinary that we could read their own words about what they've done, what they're doing, and that's why they want to stop Assange.
Can you explain the latest news over the past week, what the petition demands, and the recent response to this petition?
Yes, allow me to, and I will definitely answer that very important question. Allow me to just say up front, Of course, it's not my petition. It's the petition of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. And I need to say up front that we have a rule in the Lawyers Committee. I'm on the board of the Lawyers Committee that to make any official statement on behalf of the Lawyers Committee per se, there need to be two of the attorneys from the board on the radio or television program. Mm-hmm. So I'm speaking as a private citizen, but of course I'm knowledgeable because I am on the board. So with that that upfront statement, let me answer your question. Okay, so the bottom line is, people, we have had an historic breakthrough for 9/11 Truth and Justice on November 7th. So it was a little bit ago now, and I can explain if you're interested why it took a while to get the information out to the public, which we did in the last few days. But about 3 days ago, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry announced in official press releases, and I will send that to you, by the way, for a link on your website if there is one to go with the audio and visual of this show. The Lawyers Committee announced that on November 7th, the Lawyers Committee received an official letter, which I will send you also for your website, an official letter from the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. That's the federal courthouse in Manhattan that has the jurisdiction for the World Trade Center events on 9/11. And we received a letter saying, to our shock and pleasant surprise, that the U.S. Attorney would be doing as we demanded, which is to follow the law. And he cited the federal statute that they're going to follow, and that federal statute explicitly in its text requires them, and they said they would do it, to submit our grand jury petition, which is online on the Lawyers Committee website for the world to read, www.lcfor911.org, that they will be submitting our petition and the 57 evidentiary exhibits proving that the official story of what brought down World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7 on 9/11, the latter not hit by any plane whatsoever and came down in a classic controlled demolition, will be submitted to a specially convened special criminal grand jury. This is historic.
Wow. This is the biggest news I've heard in quite some time regarding 9/11. And we'll go to Richard right away as well, but because I want to hear his comments on this news. But Barbara, do you believe there's a clear path forward in exposing the crimes that occurred on 9/11?
Well, yes. I mean, the petition is the beginning, of course, of that clear path forward. People need to understand that this is an official action. We have moved from 9/11 forensic evidence and facts to 9/11 justice. And one of the most exciting pieces of news is that I drafted on behalf of the Lawyers Committee, I'm kind of their, publicity person as well as their research person. But the other day, 2 days ago, I drafted a press release, 400-word press release that was put out 2 days ago in the morning, 8:30 a.m. East Coast time by PR Newswire. And it went to all of the entire US 1 market, which means as many as 8.5 million readers and viewers. And it has already been picked up by 165. I can send you the list. You can put it on your website. I'm going to send it to Richard and A&E as well, architects and engineers as well. It's already been picked up by over 165 mainstream newspapers like the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and mainstream radio and mainstream television, and they have reposted it on their websites verbatim, including the embedded links to our petition, to our evidentiary exhibits, and to the U.S. Attorney's letter. This is official action, and they are covering it in the mainstream media.
Yeah, and I think it's amazing to finally see something like this coming forward of this magnitude. It gives me a lot more hope than the 28 pages catastrophe. But Richard, what are your thoughts on this recent news, and how important has the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry been to supporting what AI 911 has been working so hard on exposing for so many years?
Yeah, the Lawyers Committee has been doing exceptional work. They've been with us step by step, and now they're launching forward. Maybe we were carrying the burden, from back in from 2006 and 7.
Mm. Well, back in his demolition access to the World Trade Towers, Richard Gage runs down all the connections to the powers that be, and the commercial and technical connections, interests, and all. But the case I want to just put to highlight everything is the Brian Terry murder, which is to say the Sean Souter murder, which is to say the David Shale. I might get the last one wrong, but it's all in Rod Rosenstein's investigation of the gun walking called Fast and Furious. Now, if in March WikiLeaks announces, hey, there's all these secret emails, then the powers that be are going to say, well, shit, we better get the jump on it. So in the next month, April, the files, the gunwalking files in Uriel Patino, who gets to sell almost 1,000 of these automatic weapons to the Sinaloa cartel, and the HSBC money laundering is dealt with by Loretta Lynch, who meets on the tarmac with Billy the Kid Clinton gang member and ex-Oval Office member of that 1999 meeting with Harari and Poppy Bush, Poppy and Harari on the Essex County Airport. Well, all that goes into a lot of Where was I? Oh, because I just lost my cue. Okay, back to this.
Except that the media has now turned on Assange and WikiLeaks because they are he exposed Hillary Clinton, and the contents of those emails are forgotten and are buried in all of this. It was, well, I lost the election, and let's not talk about what those emails said. They immediately, I remember Susan Rice tweeting out right away, this is all, you know, the whole thing was about Russia from the beginning, because that's the great scapegoat of the United States during the First and Second Cold Wars. Anything that happens that's damaging to ruling interests, you know, blame it on Russia. And even in, I've said this, it's controversial, not the first time I've said something controversial, that even if Russia did hack these emails, and if they did somehow give them to...
But the point is...
When streams are ripe and swelled with rain,
the bridge over the river Mina.
May she will stay, resting in my arms again. June, she'll change her tune. In restless walk she'll prowl the night. July she will fly and give no warning to her flight. August die she must. The autumn winds blow chilly and cold. September I'll remember. A love once new has now grown old.
Cut out some intermediary to WikiLeaks so that WikiLeaks wouldn't know it was from Russia. It was still true. And it was a service to the American voter. It
Absolutely.
Was a service to the American voter for us to know what Hillary Clinton was all about. And that confirmed a lot of suspicions people had about her, but also revealed things no one had a clue about, particularly the manipulation of the primary process. Now, the charge is that why didn't they put out emails about Trump? Well, I have two answers for that. They didn't have any. Stefania Maurizio, who works for La Repubblica in Italy, is one of the partner media with WikiLeaks. And she's written and spoken about this, including in
the Clinton dirt on Trump. And they were admitting it, and then they realized it had been published already.
So